Indie Comics. Indie Comics.
Welcome back to the second part of our deep dive into the Fantastic Four. Last week, we talked about the creation of the FF, and Steve really broke down the major comic book runs, as he had read way more FF comics than me, though I am working on it now. But today, we're going to talk about the Fantastic Four on a radio program with someone playing Johnny Storm that is going to shock you. We're also going to dive into the various television shows and films that have come out over the last 60-plus years of their existence, and that is a bit more in my current wheelhouse, so I'm looking forward to getting into that. But before we get started, was there anything you wanted to say, Steve?
Yes, it's clobbering time. While I'll admit that I prefer the original comics version of the Fantastic Four, there have been times that adaptations got the idea down decently well on the screen, but this is also a franchise that has struggled quite a lot on the big screen, which we'll get into as well. I'm looking forward into getting into those ups and downs. So, Mike, how would you like to get us started?
I would love to. I think the earliest incarnation of the FF outside the comics came in a 1967 animated cartoon produced by Hanna-Barbera. The show ran for 20 episodes on ABC from September 9th, 1967 to September 21st, 1968. I think that Fantastic Four cartoon was part of a package deal with ABC, who also ran a Spider-Man cartoon concurrently with the FF1 on Saturday morning cartoons, but produced under another company. Saturday morning cartoons were awesome, and kids who don't get to experience that anymore are just missing out. I have said this before, but it was just not Saturday morning until I heard Stan Lee call me a true believer in the Marvel Hour in the early 80s. Now, I have not personally seen the 67 FF cartoon made by Hanna-Barbera, but I watched the crap out of the 67 Spider-Man series. And while they are made by different companies, I can say that the Spider-Man show does not stand the test of time well. It didn't bother me when I was a kid watching reruns of it. The animation is really terrible, though, and when looked at with modern eyes. But it would not be the only cartoon made back in the day that was not good, but we didn't notice it as kids.
I still haven't seen much of the 67 FF cartoon. I've seen some clips from it, though, and it looks decently made for its time. I mean, the art style at least looked in line with Jack Kirby's approach to the Fantastic Four. The storytelling seemed like a typical Hanna-Barbera show of its time, though, really. Not bad, but I guess serviceable. If you want a really good Hanna-Barbera show about a family of explorers, I would instead look to the 1964 version of Johnny Quest, which came out only a few years before this. The art on that was a lot more vibrant and interesting, and you get more of the family drama, as well as some really good action adventure. That show was also made by people like Doug Wildey and Alex Toth, who understood how to bring the comic book style to the small screen. It's just a shame that we never got that from the 67 FF series, but I digress. What's the next show on our list, Mike?
Well, the next time we hear from the FF outside of the comics was actually a short-lived radio program in 1975 that adapted the Lee Kirby stories for the radio into short 5-minute episodes. Check this out, though. The series is most notable for casting Bill Murray as the Human Torch just 2 years before his SNL debut. Imagine that performance. I would love to hear an episode of that show just for the Murray performance. Also in the cast were Bob Maxwell as Reed Richards, Cynthia Adler as Sue Storm, Jim Pappas as Ben Grimm, and Jerry Terhaden as Dr. Doom. Other Marvel characters featured in the series included Ant-Man, Prince Namor, Nick Fury, and the Hulk. Stan Lee narrated the series, and the scripts were taken almost verbatim from the comic books. The team appeared on the Power Records album Fantastic Four, The Way It Began book and record set from 1974, which was an audio dramatization of Fantastic Four 126.
Bill Murray as Johnny Storm sounds awesome, I got to admit. That might be worth digging up just to see how good he was in the role. I mean, it is interesting how the old Saturday Night Live crew would occasionally brush against the world of comics, though. It reminds me a little of the old Marvel team-up comic where Spider-Man teamed up with the Primetime Players from SNL. And to bring this back to the Fantastic Four, I can't tell you how many 80s fan casts had Harold Ramis as Reed Richards. It is a real shame that that never ended up happening because it would have been perfect.
I can see that working in the 80s in a funnier take on the FF for sure. But, I mean, I honestly don't think I could take Ramis seriously as Reed Richards. He's just too much of a comedic actor for me. But that is just me. After the radio show, we would not see the FF again until 1978's The New Fantastic Four, although it was just called The Fantastic Four on the screen. The New Fantastic Four was produced by DePatie Frayling and only ran for 13 episodes from September to December in 1978. However, the Human Torch was missing from the show, and in his place was the Herbie unit. I have not seen this show, but the FF without Johnny Storm sounds stupid. Although that time Spider-Man replaced Johnny Storm you mentioned last week does sound interesting. So, I mean, maybe it's not entirely dumb. The very next year, though, in 1979, The Thing was featured as half of the Saturday morning cartoon Fred and Barney Meet the Thing. However, this character was The Thing in name only, and even Fred and Barney don't actually appear in the episode despite the title. The Thing's name was changed to Benji Grimm, and he was a teenage boy that had magical Thing rings that allowed him to turn into The Thing when he put them together and said, "Thing rings, do your thing." But the next time they are in an animated series would not be for over a decade. Do you want to tell us about that series, Steve?
Sure thing. And I say I'm going to not be surprised if it had been this version that kept it off the air for 10 years. Anyway, I will say that everything I've seen about the FF shows in the late 70s just look really dumb, especially taking out the Human Torch and the idea of the Thing ring. I cannot even say it without losing it. I get the distinct feeling that they were trying to tone the show down for the kids, and it just wasn't needed. Though, fortunately, things would start looking up a bit more with the 90s FF series. In the early 90s, Genesis Entertainment and New World Entertainment syndicated a new Fantastic Four animated series as part of the Marvel Action Hour weekend block with Iron Man, the animated series. Later, the hour was renamed Marvel Action Universe, the second use of that name. Both Iron Man's and the Fantastic Four's first season was made with cost-effective animation by Wong Film Productions and Kennedy Cartoons, and the show aired on Fox Kids. The first half of the hour was an episode of Iron Man, the second half an episode of the Fantastic Four, and I do remember watching that at the time. During the first season, Stan Lee was featured speaking before each show about characters in the following episode and what had inspired him to create them. The series ran for two seasons with 13 episodes per season, making 26 episodes in total from September 24th, 1994 to February 24th, 1996.
I just want to say something real quick there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I really wish that it talked about Stan Lee doing a little narration at the beginning of each episode with what inspired him to create the characters. I really wish they had that on Disney Plus. That would be awesome. I'd love to see that in those episodes.
Yeah, there's a lot that they take out of Disney Plus, and we're going to be talking about that in a minute. But I'll be honest, I generally like this FF show overall, especially in the second season. You get a decently comics accurate take on the FF with episodes drawing very noticeably on the old Stan Lee and Jack Kirby stories, and even the occasional adaptation of John Byrne stories here and there. Generally, what really shines in these episodes, even the worst ones, are the elements that came out of the comics. But the first season did have some growing pains, even if it added some brighter points too. Mike, did you want to get into that?
Absolutely. In season one, the Silver Surfer and the Coming of Galactus two-parter is one of the better ones, in my opinion. Aside from Reed calling Johnny Storm his brother-in-law son, I particularly liked the opening where Dr. Frankenstein is bringing his monster to life because Ben liked it. I know that he feels like a monster despite his heart of gold. Also, Dr. Frankenstein ignores the woman who was warning him of the danger because nothing must stand in the way of science. And science making Ben Grimm into a monster is reflective of the bitterness Ben has against Reed for making him that way, even if Ben tries to bury that. And it is, of course, reflective of how Reed's pursuit of science, despite the dangers, led to what made them the FF. Uatu is a bit confusing, though. He He puts up not one, but two screens to stop the Silver Surfer and Galactus from discovering the Earth, and he directly gets in the way and blocks Reed Richards from attacking Galactus, yet says that he is forbidden to act. When Sue confronts him about this, a little late, granted, and he basically says that talking is not acting, and so he has not violated the decree. But these things I can set aside as I realize this is clearly aimed at children. All in all, it's a great two-parter for the first season of the show, which, in my opinion, did not have many good episodes. I have one more episode connected to this one that I want to talk about from the first season, but were there any episodes that jumped out at you in the first season?
There were, but before I get into my main choice, I do want to mention one other episode called Incursion of the Skrulls. I mentioned this one because you cannot find this on Disney+. It's not listed there at all. But you do know that it exists because in the subsequent Skrull episode after this, Stan Lee absolutely mentions it on the air. So you know it's there, it's just missing. But beyond that, you can find this episode for cheap on Amazon, though, and which is how I saw it. But it is a pretty good Skrull episode. The Skrulls try to divert the FF away while they use their shape-shifting to discredit the team. And the FF has to get away from the U.S. government while figuring out how to stop the Skrull plan. What I like about this one is that Reed actually comes up with a pretty clever way to trick the Skrulls out of invading the Earth, and he even wins medals from the Skrull for doing it. It also makes a nod to Lee and Kirby with the four Skrulls that turn into goats. They were cows in the comics, but it's a clear reference to that very early story.
You know, I did a little research into why Incursion of the Skrulls might not have made it onto Disney Plus, and I have a theory as to why it was removed. My first theory is 9/11. We see the World Trade Center destroyed in that episode, and perhaps they did not want to remind people of the 22-year-old event. My reason for this line of thought is that editing the past entertainment seems to be a modern trend. What's more is I can't help but notice that the quest of the Red Skull was removed from Spider-Man and his amazing friends. Why? I think it's because the story focuses on Red Skull's past in Nazi Germany, and he attempts to destroy the world. But what do you think about that, Steve? Do you think I'm way off here?
No, I don't think you are at all. It does sound like the kind of corporate-driven decision I'd expect from Disney, where they try to avoid controversy by shoving things down the memory hole. I'm not a fan of it. But as you say, it was over two decades since that event, and I think we're removed enough from it now that showing that kind of content shouldn't be a problem anymore. And to be honest, I never even made the 9/11 connection when I watched the episode. I'll add that the episode came out quite a few years before that event happened, so it was clearly not an intentional reference. So this just sounds silly to me, but let's move on. Like you, the Coming of Galactus two-parter is my favorite season one episode as well. I appreciate that many of those stories were adapted directly from Lee and Kirby. For all its flaws, it drew on the right source material, and that makes a huge difference. Silver Surfer and the Coming of Galactus adapts the Galactus story from issues 48 to 50 of Fantastic Four. The basic elements are adapted pretty well, where Uatu the Watcher intervenes to save the Earth from the Devourer of Worlds. They actually do make some small changes from the comics. Some of them make sense. Originally, the Thing fights Galactus's Punisher robot, but it becomes a protracted fight with the Silver Surfer in this version. As an aside, the Punisher robot has nothing to do with Frank Castle. The original story was published well before Castle was created. I just thought I had to point that out. Anyway, I felt like that move gave Surfer a bigger story role and set up his character arc well. The robot also ends up being switched out later for Galactus's other heralds like Fire Lord and Terrax, which I thought was a more questionable decision. Also, you get a semi-comedic arc where the FF gets evicted from the Baxter building, loosely based on a plot point from the FF comics. But for the most part, the structure and the substance of Lee and Kirby's story is reflected well in these episodes. The grandeur and the cosmic scale is there. Galactus is presented as a godlike force of nature, and the Surfer's moments with Alicia are well handled.
I actually really like that we both picked that episode as our favorites from the series. But I have to say that there were more changes to the story than I was aware of, and that does take something away from it for me. The other episode I really enjoyed from season one was actually connected to this one, and that was The Silver Surfer and the Return of Galactus. I particularly liked how Doom stole the Surfer's powers and that Reed got Galactus to set it right by getting Dr. Doom to leave the solar system and thus triggering Galactus to come and enforce his decree. That whole thing felt like it was just right out of the comics. Now, I know that Dr. Doom did steal the Silver Surfer's powers in the comics, but was it anything anything like what we got in that season finale there.
No, not really. They drew the stealing of Surfer's powers as a starting point, but it never played out the way that they showed it in the cartoon. The cartoon draws a little more on the Emperor Doom approach, showing Doom as he uses his powers to conquer the world, but I don't recall that being in the Lee Kirby story. I also think that they changed the ending a bit as well.
That it is not how they handled it in the comics kind of make me like the episode a little less, honestly. I thought Reed's solution totally felt like it could have come right out of the comics. And knowing that they were drawing on those stories, I assume that it was. I guess I should not expect such accuracy in the show. I just imagine it closer to the source material. But why don't we get into the much better second season of the Fantastic Four?
Awesome. So let's do it. Both the Fantastic Four and Iron Man series were radically retooled for its second and final season. As previously mentioned, the animation for season one's 13 episodes was done by Wong Film Productions and Kennedy Cartoons, while the second season's animation was provided by the Philippine Animation Studio. So season two ended up sporting brand new opening sequences, improved animation, and more mature writing. The first season was primarily written by Rod Friedman, while the second season was overseen by Tana Tataranowitz. I can't pronounce that. There were noticeably fewer introductions by Stan Lee, with several of the new shorter intros being used more than once. So season two ended up being a drastic overhaul in the scheme of things. I'll also add that the staff changes led to a notable shift in quality of writing for the better. Larry Houston, who was involved with the animation for X-Men the Animated Series, was a producer on the second season. Houston was known for being a fan of the comics, and he brought that same fidelity from X-Men the Animated Series over to the FF. The show looks a lot better in the second season, and Houston's style is extremely noticeable if you compare to his work on X-Men TAS. I'll also add that I was impressed by the writing of Sidney Clark, who wrote some of the best episodes of Season 2. The addition of both of them dramatically improved the show, though it's a shame that it wasn't enough to give the FF a third season.
I think that a third season would have been nice. It's like the series was just getting started with season two. And actually, I can't help but notice that the whole first season acted like there was no other heroes on the earth except for the Fantastic Four. Despite both Spider-Man the Animated Series and X-Men the Animated Series running concurrently with it. The only difference I can think of is the Spider-Man the Animated Series and X-Men the Animated Series were made specifically for Fox Kids, and the FF and Iron Man shows were only syndicated to Fox Kids. But they seem to have gotten some of that sorted out by the time season two came around, as we see the characters from all over the Marvel Universe. Even though some of them are just a blink and you'll miss it type of cameos as the main characters go about town. Also, the improvement in the animation and the writing is like night and day. Granted, Ron Friedman, as I understand it, was told to write the show more humorously and the landlady, Miss Lavina Forbes, was added to the story specifically for humor. Oh, and by the way, Forbes was voiced by none other than Stan Lee's wife, Joan.
That is very cool. I never knew Joan Lee was involved in any Marvel shows, but that's great. As for the direction of the show, I'd attribute some of that shift to the involvement of Larry Houston. Houston would often do much the same for X-Men, the Animated Series, where we would drop Easter eggs of other Marvel characters from time to time, and that created more of a sense of a coherent universe. These would be a good crowd-pleaser moments, but it also created a sense of a larger Marvel universe as well. In Doomsday, for instance, you see brief shots of the Avengers, the New Warriors, and the X-Men. So you see what they were doing while Doom was terrorizing the planet. I'm also glad that they included episodes guest-starring other Marvel characters such as Daredevil. All of that helped create a living, breathing, animated Marvel universe between the different shows.
Actually, speaking of Daredevil, the very first episode from the second season I want to talk about has Daredevil in it. In our top five animated Batman films episode, we talked about the self-sacrificing hero in regards to Batman and Spider-Man. But in season two, episode one, And a Blind Man Shall Lead Them, we see that Ben Grimm is clearly a self-sacrificing hero in the animated universe as well. He was truly happy, joyous even, over not looking like the Thing anymore. But he sacrificed that shot of really being happy for the good of the group and the need of the FF. Also, in that same episode, Dr. Doom puts a device on Ben that increases his weight 1,000-fold. Let me put that into perspective for you. Ben Grimm weighs 500 pounds anyway. That means he lifted 500,000 pounds when he stood up. I mean, that's not Hulk levels, but that's still pretty freaking impressive if you ask me. If I recall, though, I think you wanted to talk about season 2, episode 13, didn't you, Steve?
I do, but before I get into that, Ben has a gift for being able to surpass his physical limits through sheer rage and willpower. This is usually how he's able to trade blows with the Hulk as well as he does. And Doom found this out the hard way. Ben has every right to unload on Doom here, too. I mean, Doom took away all hope that Ben had to live the life that he wanted. And so the scene where he beats on down on Doom is really satisfying to watch. But since you asked about episode 13, let's dive into it. Doomsday kind of goes back to the previous formula of having Doom steal the Silver Surfer's powers. However, this episode pulls it off better. You get a lot less of the season one silliness and a lot more of the threat of cosmic power Doom. Doom starts off by defeating the Thing by freezing him into a statue. And then he takes out the rest of the FF individually until he goes after Reed and Sue, which I will say is actually good planning. The interesting thing is that he doesn't kill them. I think the idea was to deliberately make the FF feel helpless as Doom run roughshod over the entire world. He wants Richards to admit that he's powerless against the cosmic Doom. And watching Doom try to take over the world is pretty well done. Eventually, the FF does trick Doom into losing his power by having him run into Galactus's barrier, which is meant to keep the Surfer on Earth. But generally, I feel like they did a good job with this one all in all. It's not perfect, and I don't think this Doom is quite as competent as the comics version, particularly towards the end. And I feel that the ending could have been a little better executed. But overall, I think it's one of the better portrayals of Doom that we've seen on screen to date.
I think I can certainly agree with that. I had a similar thought about Doom not quite being up to par with his comics counterpart, but I think it does work well enough for this episode. But I'd like to talk about my next pick from the series from season 2, episode 5, Worlds Within Worlds. This episode made me very impressed with both Susan Storm and Ben Grimm. And we talked a bit about the comics version of this story in the Burn Run last week, but I don't see how one could not be impressed with Ben Grimm's display of courage overcoming Psycho Man's fear ray. He faced his greatest fear and fought through it to victory. Honestly, I think Ben is my favorite on the team after going through over the comics and stuff for this episode. But let's talk about Susan Storm, or rather Malice, in this episode. Maybe I don't have a big enough imagination, but I'll be honest to say, I never even considered Susan using her powers like she does in that episode. I honestly viewed her as kind of a support character, but I see now that she could easily take down the whole team if she wanted to. I was particularly impressed when she created a force field in Reed's stomach and made it grow little by little until he was about to burst, and how she folded up Ben like a transformer encased in that tiny box of a shield. Also, did you notice that they mentioned being at the Avengers Mansion? And there were Avengers in the very next episode. They really opened up the Marvel Universe in the second season, but I believe your second pick was episode 7 from the second season, wasn't it, Steve?
It is, but if I can comment on your pick a little, I think you're finally realizing what it is I love about Sue. Pretty much her entire arc during John Byrne's run was about elevating Sue into the most powerful member of the entire team, in very much the same way. That episode adapted the end of that story where Psycho Man and the Hate Monger turned her into Malice. They softened the arc a bit, which dealt with heavier themes in the comics like racial violence. They just probably thought that it was a bit too much for kids' television and they brought it in. Also, as an aside, the story originally had She-Hulk in Ben's role in the comics. The original comic story took place when Ben was away from the team. So this version you actually see, that was actually on the writers of the show. But so even though they rushed the story a bit, they still made it work. So that is definitely a good enough episode to pick. But let's move on to my next pick from there. I'd like to mention that as a huge fan of the Black Panther, Prey of the Black Panther from season 2, episode 7 is my favorite on-screen portrayal of the Black Panther. While I love Chadwick Boseman and the MCU handled T'Challa decently in Civil War and in the first film, it just wasn't the Black Panther that I hoped to see. I'm a fan of Stan Lee and Christopher Priest's Black Panther, the guy who is several steps ahead of everybody, always has a plan, and who just wants to honor his father. We never saw that Panther in the MCU, and it was a huge missed opportunity, especially after Chadwick Boseman passed away, sadly. But Prey of the Black Panther gave us that Panther, properly adapting to T'Challa's introduction, where the Black Panther defeats the FF by himself. On top of that, they got Keith David, who I love, to voice T'Challa, and he's absolutely the perfect choice for that version of the Black Panther. While Panther isn't really the focus of the episode, really, speaking as a huge T'Challa fan, getting T'Challa right earns a lot of bonus points for this show, in my view.
See, I have mentioned that a couple of episodes shine a little dimmer for me, knowing how much it was changed from the source material. And here's an example of a time where they really nailed it. That's a great pick, Steve. Overall, though, if I could talk about my closing thoughts on the series, I think the 94 Fantastic Four series was just okay. I mean, if we're putting the bar at Spider-Man and X-Men, the animated series, then Fantastic Four, even season two, which is monumentally better than season one, falls short by comparison. That said, seeing Ghost Rider take down Galactus with the pennant stare in season two, episode eight, when calls Galactus, was very awesome. And I think might be one of my favorite and most memorable scenes in the series. Yeah, a big plus for me was also having Michael Dorn, aka Worf, play Gorgon of the Inhumans. That was just awesome. I like to see that. In season two, episode 11, Hopelessly Impossible was impossible for me to get through. Impossible Man is an annoying character, if you ask me, and we talked a little bit about that last week. But my general impression with the show was that they only had 5 minutes of story for that week. So they had to make up most of that episode with clips from previous episodes, which might have been cool if I hadn't just sat there and watched them all in a row. And I was just catching an episode here or there on Saturday mornings. So I'll be honest and say that I only watched 10 minutes of that 20-minute episode.
You know, I think I ended up enjoying the show more than you did, though I totally see where you're coming from. I agree that FF doesn't hit the same heights as X-Men or Batman, and the first season does drag the quality down considerably. Ron Friedman's work was just not as good as the team that came on board with season two, and it shows. At the same time, I put season two of FF among the best adaptations of the Fantastic Four that I've ever seen to date. They've respected the source material while still bringing the classic stories to a new audience, even if it wasn't to the level of the very best of the 90s animated shows.
You know, that's true. Perhaps I'm being too harsh comparing the show to the greatest animated shows of all time. The second season in particular was very good and less aimed specifically at just children. The Fantastic Four made several other appearances during that time period, though. They also guest starred in the Secret Wars story arc from the 1994 Spider-Man animated series. And The Thing guest starred with a small cameo from the other Fantastic Four members in the Fantastic Fortitude episode of the 1996 The Incredible Hulk series. Different Fantastic Four members appear briefly and with little or no dialogue and are mentioned various times throughout the first season of The Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes. The most expansive appearances are in the episode The Private War of Doctor Doom, in which the Avengers team up with the Fantastic Four to battle the titular supervillain. And in the final episode of season two, in which the groups team up with to battle Galactus. The Thing becomes a member of the New Avengers in episode 23 of season 2. The Fantastic Four also appear in a children's show, The Superhero Squad Show, in the episodes If This Be My Thanos and The Last Exit Before Doomsday. The Fantastic Four appear in The Hulk in the Agents of Smash episode Monsters No More. In that episode, the Agents of Smash assist the Fantastic Four in thwarting the Tribbitite invasion.
When I think of Tribbitite, I keep thinking of Tribbles, but that's neither here nor there.
Yep.
Although I don't think I've ever seen any of those episodes, I can add a little bit on one of them. The Private War of Dr. Doom is a reference to an Avengers storyline that was written by Jerry Conway and Jim Shooter. My understanding is that they changed the story on that one. In the comics, the Avengers are manipulated into fighting Doom as part of a scheme by the undersea warlord Atuma. It seems like the Atuma angle was written out, but it keeps the Doom Avengers conflict intact. But why don't we get into the next series featuring the four?
That sounds like a great idea, Steve. Let's talk about the last Fantastic Four animated show that I am aware of, and that is Fantastic Four World's Greatest Heroes. In the United States, Fantastic Four World's Greatest Heroes had an erratic airing schedule on Cartoon Network, having premiered as part of Toonami on September 2nd, 2006. It ran for only 8 of the season's 26 episodes before being pulled. It subsequently returned to the network starting in June 9th, 2007, shortly before the release of the film Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer. The second launch of the show aired only 9 episodes, leaving 9 installments not televised in the USA. The show aired on Boomerang for a brief time before moving to Nicktoons in 2009 for the final episodes. And that is all the technical stuff. But let me switch over into the initial impressions of the show. Now, I have to say that I got a serious anime vibe from the Fantastic Four World's Greatest Heroes, and it took a little bit to adjust to. But the art style seems to be very reminiscent of anime to me. I brought this up on Twitter and had some interesting responses. I have heard that the inspiration might be from Dragon Ball Z, Avatar The Last Bender, and other animated shows that were on Toonami, as they were particularly hot at the time. And as I mentioned, Toonami is where the show first aired, so that would make sense. My understanding is that there are even a few known anime artists who worked on the series, but what do you think about all that, Steve?
That can very well be the case. There is a definite Western-style anime approach with this show that comes through. To be fair, that's not always a bad thing. It is interesting that you mentioned Avatar: The Last Airbender, because it took that kind of Western anime approach, and it worked. It might be that the FF was trying to do another show in that vein, for all I know. Avatar was released in 2005, so the timing would be consistent with an attempt to follow that trend. I've only watched a little bit of Avatar, so I'm no expert, but it seems like the show took the long-form anime approach much more than World's Greatest Heroes did. The FF show tended to go much more self-contained in its storytelling and much more exaggerated in its treatments of the characters, both in the writing and in the art style. So I'm guessing that they went off the surface elements of anime more than the substance that you typically find in a lot of Japanese anime shows. Still, I will admit that the art style initially put me off from the show at first. I didn't really care for the uniform designs, and I was a bit concerned about getting more anime-style writing in this show. It's definitely acquired taste if you're not into anime or manga, and my anime tastes tend to lean more into old-school-style shows like Cowboy Bebop, Ninja Scroll, and so on. So the style they used on this show took some getting used to for me. As I finally started watching World's Greatest Heroes, though, I realized that the show was much better than I originally had took it for. Much of the reason for that is that Craig Kyle and Chris Yost were involved with the show, and they've done some really solid work in Marvel's animated shows over the years, and they delivered the goods pretty well here too.
I really think that they did too. In fact, I will go as far as to say this is actually my favorite animated FF show, but I will admit that I too had similar aversions to the show based solely on its art style. Sorry if this bums our listeners out, but I don't like anime. It was not until diving back into the comics again that I gave it a shot, and I too liked it more than I thought I would. So I would like to transition into discussing some of the episodes that jumped out at us watching the series. We have both picked out a couple of episodes apiece, and chronologically speaking, Steve, I believe the one you wanted to discuss first was from Season 1, Episode 10, and I figured you probably ought to start us out with your pick, being that all the rest of them are from Season 2.
That sounds good. Let's do that. So we'll start with Imperious Rex. The title, of course, refers to Namor's iconic catchphrase, so you know right away that this is an episode dealing with Atlantis and the Submariner. The episode does tweak with some elements of Namor's backstory. For instance, he isn't an amnesiac in this version, and Namor starts off in his place as King of Atlantis. Pretty much he arrives after destroying a fishing boat in New York Harbor, making an ultimatum to the surface world. From there, Sue and Johnny intervene, and things get crazier from there. Now, I like this version of Namor's introduction for a couple of reasons. One, I appreciate that Namor and Sue's relationship begins from a position of mutual respect, and they give Namor a valid reason to take notice of Sue. Sue plays the role of diplomat in this episode, and she's the one person who seems to appreciate Namor's point of view, even if she disagrees with his methods. So when they tease the inevitable triangle between Reed, Sue, and Namor, I felt like they established a good foundation to sell that. Beyond that, though, I like that they never go too far with the love triangle aspect. It's clear that they're building an attraction, but their relationship never goes all that far. The whole thing runs on subtext, and that comes across as more believable to me. The story then becomes about Sue choosing between two worlds, and also about Reed deciding what's most important to him. I'll also add that this version of Johnny exaggerates his hot-headedness a lot, coming across as a jerk at times even. So every time Johnny opens his mouth, Namor wants to rip him apart, and I can't blame him for that. He's annoying. Some of those moments are entertaining and sometimes even funny to watch, though. Also, in general, I dig Marvel's version of Atlantis, and unlike other versions, I think that this episode treated that mythos reasonably well.
Well, I am not as immersed in the mythos as you are, Steve. From what I know of it, I have to agree with your assessment there. And really, almost anything would be better than the MCU's version. But seriously, I did enjoy the episode, and while I think that Sue toying with the idea of being unfaithful even in subtext is inappropriate, I do agree that they did not take it to a point where it was too far. Ultimately, depending on how you want to see it, I think Sue merely respects Namor, like you said, and it just came across differently at times. My first pick on this series is from Season 2, Episode 3, Shell Games. Now, ignoring an issue I had with the portrayal of the Iron Man armor that I will get into in a moment, I want to start off by talking about things I enjoyed about this episode. I really liked having Iron Man in this episode. It was a nice callback to the 94 Saturday morning cartoon when Iron Man was and the Fantastic Four were part of Marvel's Action Hour. I thought Tony Stark was done very well. I think I prefer a less obnoxious Tony like what we got in Phase 1 from the MCU. But I also liked the more aggressive Reed Richards in the episode. He totally confronted Tony Stark with unequivocal accusations, which leads me to think that choosing to make their entrance to Tony the way they did really pissed Richards off. I got the impression that it was offensive that another superhero would have attacked them. In short, I think his feelings were hurt, and more so even than the other FF members who were mostly observers in that confrontation. Plus, you have to appreciate the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade reference from Dr. Doom when he told Iron Man, "You have chosen poorly, Steve."
"You chose the wrong friends, Tony. Now what was briefly yours is now mine." Well, thinking about it, the actor who played Belloc would have been a good Doom now that I think about it. But yeah, I totally dig the indie reference. The episode probably worked for you more than it did for me overall, but there were bits here and there that were fun. I liked seeing the FF fight the entire Iron Man armory, including some of my favorite suits. They brought in the Silver Centurion and the Stealth Armor from the second Michelinian Leyden run, so they did their homework there. At the same time, I was a bit irritated by Tony here, even if they got him right in some respects. I don't think that they'd figure out that as cool as Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark is, nobody can pull off that version but Robert Downey Jr. The comics have sometimes done the same thing and made the same mistake, where they play up the quirky playboy shtick for comedy and it doesn't land because you don't have Downey's charisma and performance to rely on. You're better off just playing Tony straight if you don't have Downey on board, if I'm absolutely honest. But enough of my own criticisms, Mike. I think you had a problem that you wanted to bring up with Shellhead.
I do, actually. I was a little shocked by the Thing taking Iron Man's Unabeam so easily. He didn't act like that even hurt him, and that blast has obliterated targets in the past. I'm honestly not sure if that is a testament to the Thing or a lack of understanding on the part of the writers about Iron Man's Unabeam. One thing I think it does say is how desperate Tony must have felt to not just use the extremely energy-draining Unabeam, but to continue blasting it for a fair amount of time. Given that a single blast can diminish up to 20% of the armor's battery, he could not have had much more than 15% power left. That pretty much makes it so that the Iron Man armor should have been depleted completely after the Unabeam exchange with Dr. Doom, which I must say lends credence to the idea that perhaps the writers did not quite understand Iron Man or the armor. But you wanted to discuss an episode from Season 2, Episode 5, didn't you, Steve?
I sure do, but though you're probably right that they didn't think through the Iron Man suits as well as they should have. The Hulkbuster suit should have brutalized poor Ben, for instance. That armor is designed to tank on the Hulk. I did love seeing the Silver Centurion suit, though, since that's my favorite Iron Man design. But let's move on to my next pick. Frightful, which is the episode you talked about, introduces the world's greatest heroes version of the Frightful Four. Now, the Frightful Four is a group that sometimes can be interesting, and they've even gotten some victories on the FF on occasion. But in the comics, the Frightful Four tend to be about either the Wizard trying to validate his ego by beating Reed in the FF, or also trying to steal some of Reed's technology. This episode decides to do it both ways, but what I like about it is the method. So the Wizard gathers together a group, including the Trapster, Claw, and Dragon Man, and then they take a page from Baron Zemo's playbook. They pretend to be heroes and try to upstage the Fantastic Four at every turn. It ends up irritating each of the four, and it's hilarious, especially Reed trying to hide his annoyance at the Wizard. But the trick of it is that the Wizard is causing all the disasters that they end up taking credit for solving. All of this is part of a plan to get access to a government lab so that they can steal Reed's unstable molecules. Even if it isn't an original idea, I have to say that the episode actually works. I like the idea of the Frightful Four pulling a scam while also trying to humiliate the FF, both of which are completely in character for the Wizard to do. I like that Trapster gets the Paste Pot Pete jokes, which is a major part of who he is. Trapster just cannot live down the lame identity he starts with, and it irks him to no end. My only quibble with it is that in the comics, Dragon Man is a alchemical construct and not a robot. In fact, he was created by Diablo. But speaking of Diablo, he's one of my favorite FF villains, even if he's treated as a joke most of the time. So I'm looking forward to talking a bit about him. I think you had a Diablo episode that you wanted to talk about, Mike?
I certainly do, Steve. But first, I have to say that I do seem to like it when stuff gets under Reed's skin. And it seems like the Wizard certainly does that. So I like that aspect of that episode a lot as well. But you're right, I do have another pick involving Diablo from Season 2, Episode 8, Johnny Storm and the Potion of Fire. I talked about bringing this up last week, so here it is. One of the greater parts of the episode is Reed's absolute refusal to accept the existence of magic. This would actually have been fine if he had come at it with the Arthur C. Clarke angle that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But he doesn't explain it that way. He simply denies the existence of it with venomous disdain. Meanwhile, the whole episode seems to be screaming at Reed that there is such a thing as magic. In fact, being that he knows Dr. Doom so well, I would think that he would be more familiar with the subject. But to be fair, the magic angle on Dr. Doom is seemingly often disregarded. In truth, I picture Doom operating more like Diablo in this episode, combining elements of both magic and science. As far as Johnny Storm goes, I get the idea of being consumed by power. I was never a major player on the streets. I was mostly known for collecting, but for a time I did attain a level of power and position around the age of 17 and 18. And just that small taste changed me considerably, so much so that I started hating who I was and who I had become, and handed the whole business over to another person and just walked away from it all. I feel like while Johnny's case, it was superpowers, and in my case, it was more about status, I guess. But both were situations where power was increased considerably, and it had an effect on how we interacted, even with friends and family. We both became full of ourselves and drunk on power. Having gone through that, though, I feel like I learned a lot from that experience. And I feel like with Johnny's speech at the end of the episode that perhaps he had done a deep dive into his thoughts and feelings and motivations, too, and came out a little wiser like I did. So I related on that level to Johnny's story arc in this episode.
That's cool. And I totally understand where you're coming from there. I agree that the episode does handle the temptation of power well as the redemption arc later. Some of it is Johnny being under the influence of the elemental, and he's always been interested in glory and standing out compared to the rest of the team. So I can dig that aspect of it, and I can see where he would be tempted. That said, I do feel like the show does sometimes over-exaggerate Johnny's hot-headedness and jerkish tendencies. Usually, though, it's for comedy. I think they probably saw Chris Evans's performance, and they decided to play that persona up to 11. And then with the possession, they exaggerated even further, if that's even possible. And then with the... I do think that it works for the episode, though. And dealing with a boosted and possessed Johnny with alchemical-based fire powers was a really cool setup. As for Diablo and Doom, I get what you're saying there. In part one, we talked about Unthinkable, where Doom shows what he's capable of when he leans more into magic. But I think the reason Doom often doesn't do that is that he wants to prove that he's smarter than Reed, and a victory where Doom doesn't prove that he's the better scientist feels hollow to him. Doom also understands the cost of magic, and he only pays that cost when he deems the benefits to be worth it. In contrast, Diablo doesn't really care about any of that, and in the right hands, that makes him a truly dangerous and frightening villain. This leads where a lot of writers have missed the potential in Diablo as a villain, and why he works as an FF opponent if done well. I see Diablo as being fascinated by forbidden knowledge, unfettered by rules or morality. I mean, even Doom has rules he'll abide by. He's a man who operates by his own personal code of honor, as we've seen in the stories we talked about last time. But Diablo will pay any price to gain knowledge and power for himself, and if others are hurt in the process, Diablo doesn't care. He'll sacrifice anyone and everyone if it benefits his goals. And that contrasts perfectly with Reed, who is an ethical scientist who refuses to make those kinds of sacrifices. They're both fascinated by discovering new knowledge, but Reed operates by a strict set of rules, and Diablo doesn't. That's a great hero-villain conflict to work with. Sadly, though, Diablo is very often written as a joke, mainly because Stan himself didn't have a clear idea of who he was at first. So other writers ended up struggling with the character as well, even some of the really good ones. Also, Diablo tends to lose a lot of his encounters, even though he has the power to take the FF on by himself. Because of that, a lot of people don't take him seriously, including his writers, and I've even had moments where I didn't. But this episode was different. This Diablo is dangerous, creepy, and willing to use anyone to get what he wants. He leaves a deep emotional scar on Johnny, and he gives the FF a hard time even though he loses. Even though Diablo isn't the emotional core of this episode, the show seems to understand how Diablo can work effectively, and not many writers can make that work or make that claim.
You know, I totally got a Faust vibe from Diablo in this episode, that he basically had given up his soul for ultimate knowledge. I was particularly interested in him having worked on the spell for 500 years. Diablo was definitely scary in this episode, but I will agree that my perception of Doom is a little off, so my Diablo comparison was not maybe as spot on as I figured. But I think I have a better understanding now. Overall, I like this series, and I think it was much better than the 94 series. Hard Knocks certainly had a much better Thing and Hulk fight than the Nightmare and Green from the 94 series. Plus, Johnny Storm asking Ronan the Accuser if he's Angry Smurf in Trial by Fire just cracked me up.
That was a cool line. I'll give him that. My general impression of World's Greatest Heroes is that it was a surprisingly good show that did more right than I expected it to at first. I think it's likely because they borrowed a fair bit from Wade and Wieringo, which is never a bad plan. That run was amazing, and it is a great blueprint to use. There are some ups and downs with the series, some episodes that shine better than others, but I think that they did a great job in reinventing some of the classic villains, and I think they handled them more better than I've typically seen him done in other versions. And that's not an easy feat, given that most writers tend to drive the long triangle of Reed, Namor, and Sue pretty hard. I'm still not in love with the art style or the over-exaggeration of Johnny, who I think should be more nuanced, but it's a fun show that hits many of the right notes, and it can be funny too. I'd recommend it if you want a more modern FF take with some decent quality, but sadly, the films wouldn't be quite so lucky as the animated shows were. Mike, why don't you start us off on that?
Sure thing, Steve. In 1983, German producer Bernard Eichinger met with Stan Lee at his home in Los Angeles to explore obtaining an option for a movie based on the Fantastic Four. But he would not attain the rights until 1986, when Bernard Eichinger's Constantine Films bought the rights for an estimated $250,000. Warner Brothers and Columbia Pictures were interested in doing the film, but were cautious because of Eichinger's $40 to $45 million budget. But the production deadline on the contract expired on December 31st, 1992. Basically out of options and time, Bernard Eichinger approached B-movie specialist Roger Corman on the idea of producing the film on a $5 million budget in order to keep the rights, which he eventually decided to bring down to $1 million. So the first FF movie went from being $45 million movie down to a $5 million movie and then down to a $1 million movie, which actually explains a lot. By 1994, Roger Corman had made Bernard Eichinger's Ashcan movie. For those that do not know, an Ashcan movie is a low-budget piece of crap made solely for the purpose of holding on to the rights of a film. That same year, the adaptation titled The Fantastic Four had its trailer released to theaters, and its cast and director went on a promotional tour. Both Stan and Lee and Bernard Eichinger stated that the actors had no idea of the situation. The whole time, they believed they were creating a proper release. However, the movie was actually never released in theaters or even on home video. But this movie, like the producer's cut of Halloween 6, survived by way of bootleg copies. While I have not seen the movie in its entirety, I have seen a fair amount of clips from it. And while it looks like they genuinely tried to be comics accurate with the appearances, the special effects and costumes are pretty bad and I think would only really work on a stage production. But that's what happens when you cut $44 million from a movie budget. However, that is just my opinion. As it did survive in bootlegs, clearly there are those that like it. According to producer Bernard Eichinger, Avi Arad had Marvel purchase the film's negative for a few million dollars so that 20th Century Fox could go ahead with the big budget adaptation we would get in 2005. So what do you say we get into that first Fox Fantastic Four film, Steve?
Sure, let's get into it. Now under production by Avi Arad and Ralph Winter, Fox hired Chris Columbus to write and direct Fantastic Four in 1995. He developed a screenplay with Michael France, but decided to step down as director and focused on producing Fantastic Four under his 1492 Pictures company. Peter Segal was hired to direct in April 1997, but he was replaced by Sam Wiseman by the end of the year. Fox brought in Sam Hamm to rewrite the script in April of 1998 in an attempt to lower the $165 million projected budget. Much bigger than the 45, I'll tell you that. In February 1999, with development taking longer than expected, Eichinger and Fox signed a deal with Marvel to extend the control of the film rights for another 2 years, with a summer 2001 release plan and hiring Raja Gosnell to direct. However, Gosnell decided to do Scooby-Doo instead and dropped out in October of 2000. So he was replaced by Peyton Reed in April of 2001, and Mark Frost was brought on board for another rewrite. Then Reed departed in July 2003, explaining in 2015, quote, "I developed it for the better part of a year with three different sets of writers, but it became clear after a while that Fox had a very different movie in mind, and they were also chasing a release date. So we ended up parting company," unquote. Reed's version was described as being influenced by A Hard Day's Night and intended to get Alexis Denisov as Reed Richards, which, by the way, would have been a cool choice if they had gotten him. I loved him as Wesley on Angel. Sean Astin was one of the candidates to direct the movie, and he tried to secure the part of Susan Storm for either Christina Aguilera or Cameron Diaz. His reasoning for wanting to direct it, despite never having directed a feature before, nor read any of the comics, was that he wanted to step up in filmmaking, and he felt that doing a Fantastic Four film would allow him to leave a mark. While that's understandable, the FF wasn't the right vehicle to do that with. So it just was just as well that Sean Astin didn't happen. Now, despite not getting the job, Tom Rothman was impressed with his determination and hoped to work with him on a future project. So after all that, Tim Story was signed on to direct in April of 2004 after Fox was impressed with his early cut of Taxi and knowing that Story is a fan of the comics. So Simon Kinberg ended up writing uncredited drafts of the script as well. Now, this next bit is interesting. After seeing The Incredibles, Eichinger ordered significant script changes and more special effects because of similarities to that film, which I find hilarious because The Incredibles is basically a Fantastic Four movie with the serial numbers filed off. The family dynamics are similar. The powers are mostly the same but switched around. And villains like Syndrome and the Underminer have a lot in common with Dr. Doom and the Mole Man. Sad to say, The Incredibles is a better FF film than any of the FF live action films that we've seen. But let's get back to the Fox films. In 2005, the second film adaptation, Fantastic Four, directed by Tim Story, was finally released by 20th Century Fox. The film stars Ian Griffith as Reed Richards in Mr. Fantastic, Jessica Alba as Susan Storm, the Invisible Woman, Chris Evans as Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, Mike Pachiklis as Ben Grimm, the Thing, Julian McMahon as Victor Von Doom, and Kerry Washington as Alicia Masters. Last but not least, Stan the Man Lee makes a cameo appearance as the mailman Willie Lumpkin. Truly, Stan is the king of cameos.
Yes, he is. And I love seeing him even more now that he's gone. But to your bit about the casting there, I have to say that I liked both the costume and the casting for Fantastic Four. Johan Griffith played a great Reed Richards, in my opinion, and I have been a sucker for Jessica Alba since the Dark Angel TV series from 2000. I thought she was a total badass after watching that show. And while Susan Storm is a much different character than Max Guevara, I still think she did well. It was not quite the Sue I had pictured in my mind, but I was not complaining at all. Michael Chiklis did an amazing Ben Grimm and the Thing. That is almost exactly how I saw the character in my mind. Also, the practical effects costume they used for the Thing was amazing. I honestly don't know that that could be done any better, even today. But the real shocker looking back on this film was remembering that Captain America's Chris Evans played the obnoxious Johnny Storm and did it very well, I might add. I personally think that shows some breadth to Evans' acting ability. Lastly, I thought that Kerry Washington knocked it out of the park as Alicia Masters. She totally captured the spirit of that character. She had a very kind face. She was very gentle, and she seems to carry that light that Alicia does. Really, I think the one real standout spot where they blew it was Victor Von Doom. They strayed pretty far from the source material there.
Yeah, I totally agree on that. Though I will say that, unfortunately, I never watched Dark Angel, so I'll take your word on that show and Jessica Alba's performance on that. I'm going to have to see that one day. Now, in the film's defense, I actually like the casting of Julian McMahon as Doom. McMahon is charismatic and he commands attention, which is what a good Doom should be able to do. Where they failed in the character was the writing. I stand by the view that it's always a mistake to downplay the Latverian background or to try to have Doom gain the powers from the FF's accident. But they keep doing it to cut corners, and it makes Doom a less interesting villain. What makes Doom so powerful and so dangerous is his intellect, his indomitable willpower, and a scientific mind that is the equal of Reed's. Doom didn't gain powers by a twist of fate or a mistake. He sought out that power, and he built it with his own hands. Where the FF are strong because they support each other, Doom depends entirely on himself and his own genius. This is what the filmmakers keep missing, and they do it every single time. It is so frustrating. Aside from that, though, I really do like the first FF film. It's flawed, sure, and the movie is done a huge disservice by getting Doom wrong. But like you, I thought the Fantastic Four themselves were really well cast. Chris Evans as Johnny tends to be the show stealer. As you mentioned, Michael Chiklis is a great Ben, and I also really like the Thing costume. Ben is one of the best things, no pun intended, in this film. And I will say, Chiklis made such a huge impression that he did another FF-style show called No Ordinary Family, which is kind of cool. Also, Griffith and Alba do a good job as Reed and Sue. The movie got the family dynamics and the whole celebrity angle down well, too. There's some fun moments here and there as well. So I think the movie's perfectly fine. It could have been better than what we got. To date, though, this is the best Fantastic Four film in live action that we've gotten on the big screen.
I have to agree with all of that. This first film is definitely the best live action version of the FF out there right now. I'm hoping, however, that the FF movie coming in phase 6 of the MCU will top it. I'd love to see what the MCU can do with them now that they're finally back under their umbrella. I'd also like to see a good animated FF movie from Marvel Animation as well. But I would like to talk about the DVD release for the first Fantastic Four movie. The version we got in theaters is not actually the one we bought on DVD later that year in 2005. There were a few changes, including a scene where Reed Richards and Susan Storm are in a storage room in the Baxter Building, and there is a robot on the shelves that is supposed to be Herbie from the Fantastic Four animated cartoon in 1978, where he was used to replace Johnny Storm. But I think the biggest change actually came in the scene where Reed and Sue are staring at the Statue of Liberty and discussing their feelings somewhat argumentatively. On the DVD, this scene is moved to the planetarium, and while the dialogue is similar, it is adjusted to have a less argumentative tone. There's actually a theatrical cut on the DVD, but even that has a change to the scene where Reed and Sue are staring at the Statue of Liberty. In the theatrical cut, Reed gives a very strong, square jaw to portray a more manly character. But in the DVD's so-called theatrical cut, Reed looks right at the camera, breaking the fourth wall, and he makes himself look like Hugh Jackman as Wolverine instead. Apparently, the idea was to create a cinematic universe between the Fox FF, X-Men, and Spider-Man franchises. Plus, at the time, Wolverine was set to cameo in Spider-Man 2. In 2007, the extended cut of Fantastic Four was released, and it incorporated about 20 minutes of deleted scenes into the movie. These scenes delve more deeply into Ben's relationship with Alicia, Dr. Doom's attempt to break up the FF, and there's even some about Johnny Storm's womanizing behavior backfiring him, and both the scenes where Reed and Sue discuss their feelings at the Statue of Liberty and the planetarium are in it, but in this cut, the planetarium version is even longer.
Huh. I still haven't seen the extended cut, believe it or not. Some of those details sound interesting. I really probably should get a hold of that version one of these days. I do vaguely remember the Hugh Jackman appearance, and I remember there was an attempt at building a Fox Cinematic Universe early on. It's kind of like how you had a deleted scene in the X-Men movie with a walk-on from Spider-Man, even if it was meant as a joke. But let's move into our next film. The first FF movie did well enough to justify another film, so we got a sequel. That sequel, Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, directed by Tim Story and written by Don Payne, was released in 2007, the same year that the extended cut of the first film was released. Payne had said that this film was based on the Galactus trilogy, in which Galactus makes an appearance, as well as issues 57 to 60, where Doom steals the Surfer's powers. Payne has also said that the film takes inspiration from the Ultimate Marvel series, limited series, Ultimate Extinction. I'll have to take his word on that since I haven't read it, but there is a bit of Ellis in this, so I'm not surprised. My understanding, though, is that Reed's speech to General Hager about being a good little nerd was taken nearly verbatim from Ultimate Extinction 2, where he was speaking to Nick Fury. Rise of the Silver Surfer is the first live-action movie to feature Frankie Ray, who made her first comic appearance in FF 164 during the Burn Run. She's best known for her alter ego, Nova, who possesses the same flame powers as Johnny Storm, and she's one of the successors who replaced Silver Surfer's role as the Herald of Galactus. Another fun fact about Frankie Ray, she's the stepdaughter of Professor Phineas Horton, who created the Jim Hammond, the original android Human Torch. In this movie, however, she never became Nova, while her occupation as an army soldier was completely exclusive to the movie and was never affiliated with the U.S. Army in the comics. Other actors involved in this movie include Andre Brower as General Hager, Doug Jones as the Silver Surfer, Galactus as Herald, formerly known as Nornrad. Lawrence Fishburne provides the force of the Surfer, and he's very good at that. Stan Lee appears as himself in the second film as the Rejected Wedding Guest, his first Marvel appearance as Stan Lee. I'm not sure why they went for that, since they could just have brought him back as Willie Lumpkin, who'd have every reason to be at the wedding, but whatever. For this outing, some slight revisions were made to the makeup of the Thing, giving him a larger brow and broader shoulders. This brought the design more in line with the then-recent comic book revision. For Michael Chiklis' performances as the Thing, a new set of prosthetics were developed. These prosthetics were easier for Chiklis to wear, as they provide better ventilation, and they could be easily removed, in comparison to the first film's prosthetics, which required 6 hours to apply, were uncomfortable and could not be easily removed. It's generally agreed that Rise of the Silver Surfer wasn't that great, and I'm really not overly crazy about it myself. But I think you had your own criticisms about this film you wanted to bring up, Mike?
I actually have a few issues with the Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer. Namely being that his power comes from his surfboard and not the power cosmic. I did like that they kept some of the surfer's background intact, even if it's just by mention. He says that he serves Galactus to spare his homeworld, a reference to Zen Law, and by extension, the one I love. This refers to Shala Ball, who in the comics was Norrenrad's girlfriend before he became the Silver Surfer. I also thought Doug Jones did a great job as a Silver Surfer, and I honestly, I've yet to see a Doug Jones performance that I didn't think was awesome. And as far as Lawrence Fishburne goes, he was absolutely the right choice for Silver Surfer's voice. Also, that was an absolutely detestable portrayal of Galactus, so much so that it really puts a lot of the movie in a bad light for me, especially when you combine that with the Silver Surfer stuff. I commented on not liking Dr. Doom's portrayal in the first film, and it was not any better in this film. In fact, after getting teased about him actually going to be in Latveria, I was really hoping we would get a more proper Dr. Doom in the second film, like how you described earlier. So I was really let down when they glossed over it all. In the comics, Dr. Doom constantly wears his trademark suit of armor since the accident in his laboratory. There is a tradition of never showing his face under the mask by having some object come into the panel and obscure his front whenever he takes it off, with the understanding that there is nothing beneath but scar tissue. But they ruin all of that by taking away even the scars he had acquired in the first film. I suppose there was one last thing that I didn't like about the film, and that is the very obvious wig being worn by Jessica Alba. It looks terrible. It really sticks out to me. I mean, I understand that her hair suffered quite a bit with all of the bleaching of it for the 2005 movie, so I get it. But spend a few extra bucks on a proper wig. I mean, damn. Also, I think that director Tim Story had something to do with her performance as well. Check this out. Jessica Alba, upon receiving criticism about her performance in this film, said that the director, Tim Story, told her, "It looks too real. It looks too painful. Can you be prettier when you cry? Cry pretty, Jessica. Don't do that thing with your face. Just make it flat. We can CGI the tears in later." But there was one pretty funny moment in Rise of Silver Surfer. At around 54 minutes, Reed Richards says that he is engaged to the hottest woman on the planet, pointing to Sue Storm. This was, of course, a reference to the fact that Jessica Alba had, in fact, been declared the sexiest female alive just months before the release of this film.
That was a rare moment that made me laugh during that film, I don't mind saying. But as to your other points, cry pretty? I can't even with that. Not to mention the CGI tears. Why would you do that? I don't get why some directors do this kind of thing with actresses. I don't get it. But in general, they had the tools to make a really good film, but it ended up being a disappointment. I actually like the way the Surfer came off in this movie. I agree that both Jones and Fishburne were good choices to play Norrin. But then they did the same weird power transfer thing from Rising Storm, except not nearly as good. Doom wasn't great either, as you point out. And then you had Galactus as a huge purple cloud, which just seemed like an incredibly lazy way to show the character. There's no reason they couldn't have brought in an actor, put him in a purple suit, and then find a way to create the right imposing sense of scale. If you looked at the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man from Ghostbusters, that had exactly the kind of scale you would have needed. And then they used largely practical effects to make that work. The CGI was much better a couple of decades later, so there's no reason why you couldn't have had a huge guy in purple armor towering over the people of New York in 2007 with that budget. The purple cloud thing looked cheap and lazy, and it was terrible. I'm stunned that they got the Surfer to look that good and then completely phoned it in with Galactus. It's just unbelievable and a shame considering how good it could have been.
Oh, agreed. Rise of the Silver Surfer could have been and should have been better. It's not like the special effects weren't available, as you pointed out, with how good they did the Silver Surfer. And just straight up, for all you filmmakers out there, if the Ghostbusters could do it in 1984, there is no excuse. We are 100% agreed on that one. But with as bad as the second FF movie turned out to be, it was not as bad as the reboot. A reboot directed by Josh Trank, also titled Fantastic Four, was released on August 7, 2015. The film stars Miles Teller as Reed Richards, Kate Mara as Sue Storm, Michael B. Jordan as Johnny Storm, and Jamie Bell as Ben Grimm, and Toby Kebbell as Dr. Doom. This particular version of the FF is based on the Ultimate Fantastic Four. It earned poor reviews and box office results, and rightly so. With the exception of the special effects, which I thought were good, this movie would make a black hole question its own suck power. Honestly, though, I think the wrong move was going with the Ultimate version. I personally like what little I have seen of the Ultimate Universe with the two animated Ultimate Avengers films, but I had yet to talk to even one Marvel fan that had anything good to say about the Ultimate Universe outside of Miles Morales. I'm sure my friend Steve here can comment more on that part than I can, though. The fact is, though, that right, wrong, or indifferent, 21st Century Fox was purchased on March 20th, 2019, and all the film's rights of Fantastic Four were reverted back to Marvel Studios. So before I get into what's coming up in the MCU, what can you tell us about the Ultimate Fantastic Four and your thoughts on the Ultimate Universe in general, Steve?
Well, I like the Ultimate Fantastic Four at first. In fact, there was a time it was my favorite Ultimate book after Ultimate Spider-Man. I do think it started on a rocky note, though. They got Mark Miller and Brian Michael Bendis to co-write the first arc, and they were an awkward fit together. They gave us a setup with the idea that the UFF would skew younger, late teens to early adulthood, working for Sue and Johnny's father. They also decided to have the four gain their powers by experimenting with dimension travel to the negative zone, and that was a neat idea. Of course, they also made a mess of things by having Doom get caught in the accident as well. I didn't like some of the changes, while others were interesting, and some of the stories at least had the right feel to them, even if I quibbled on some of the details. Later runs would get better. You had a run by Warren Ellis that was decently enjoyable, and then Mark Miller had a solo run that I liked quite a bit. In fact, Miller introduced the concept of the Marvel zombies in one of his UFF stories, where he had the UFF meet a zombie version of the traditional FF. That one was quite a bit of fun. After Miller left, though, the quality dropped off and the book got canceled. And then the much despised Ultimatum event happened, and that pretty much destroyed not only the Ultimate FF, but the Ultimate Universe as well. The most you see from them now is Ultimate Reed, who became a villain in the 616 universe called the Maker. As for the Fan Four Stick film, oh yes, the less said about it, the better. I won't sugarcoat this. It's one of the worst comic book movies I've ever seen. To be fair, the first third of it is watchable, and it runs off the original UFF setup, which I'm not a fan of. But once the accident happens, the movie goes completely off the rails and it becomes a complete incoherent mess of a film. I agree that using the UFF origin wasn't a good idea at all. I feel like the FF works best with the team as adults and seasoned adventurers. But I also didn't really like the idea of doing the FF as a body horror film. That's not consistent with the tone of who the FF traditionally are. If you want a body horror film, Marvel flick in the style of Cronenberg, the Hulk is right over there. But that approach doesn't work for these characters and the themes and the tones of the FF. When you start with a bad foundation, you usually get a bad film, and it seems like that's what happened here.
Damn. Sounds like it was even worse than I had originally thought. So let's get on to a brighter note. As far as the MCU appearance of the FF that we're all waiting for, here are the bits I was able to dig up. In July 2019 at San Diego Comic-Con, Kevin Feige, producer and head of Marvel Studios, announced that the Fantastic Four film set within the Marvel Cinematic Universe is in development. On December 10th, 2020, during Disney's 2020 Investor Day, Kevin Feige announced that John Watts would be directing the film, but Watts left the project in April of 2022 for personal reasons. On September 10th, 2022, at the D23 Expo, Kevin Feige revealed director Matt Shackman would be taking over as Fantastic Four's director. In fact, Shackman had dropped out as the director of the new Star Trek film due to scheduling conflicts with the Fantastic Four. On July 23rd, 2022, at San Diego Comic-Con, Kevin Feige announced that the film would be released on November 8th, 2024. Also, on July 23rd, 2022, it was revealed that the film was scheduled to begin production in 2023. 4 days later, Kevin Feige revealed that the film would not be an origin story. On September 21st, 2022, Deadline reported that Jeff Kaplan and Ian Springer would be writing the film's script, but the release date has been updated as of October 11th, 2022 by Marvel Studios to be pushed back to February 14th, 2025. On February 7th, 2023, in an interview with The Wrap, Mark Shackman revealed that the film was scheduled to begin production in early 2024. On the March 31st, 2023, Hollywood Reporter reported that Josh Friedman would rewrite the screenplay, replacing Kaplan and Springer.
Right now, I'm in wait-and-see mode when it comes to the MCU FF film. The problem for me is that I've been largely burned out of the MCU because of a lot of subpar content between Phase 4 and now the start of Phase 5. The current people making these films don't seem to have much respect for the comics they're adapting or the part of the fan base that wants comic accuracy in these films. I doubt I'm alone in feeling that way either. So that's a hurdle that the FF film is going to have to overcome if they expect me to pay money for it. However, if they're serious about a course correction from Phase 4, as they've indicated, a good way to set that tone is to land the FF movie correctly. It is not too late for them to make the right decisions with this film. So we'll see. They may very well. Right now, the latest word I've been hearing is that they're considering Adam Driver for Reed Richards. While he's not my first choice, Driver is a good actor, so maybe they could make that work. I would personally prefer bringing back John Krasinski. He was a good Reed in Multiverse of Madness, even if the script wasn't really there for him. But if they show the FF the respect they deserve in their casting choices and their writing decisions, I think this film would be a good start in writing the ship again.
I feel similar about the upcoming film. As far as the wait and see thing, but I'm willing to hope for something better. Although Wakanda Forever, Prince Namor does not give me high hopes. Well, that about wraps up our Fantastic Four episode. I hope that you've had fun hanging out with us. I know that I've had fun going over this legendary team with such a huge fan like Steve. I'd like to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible and leave you with a quote about the FF from Fantastic Four 100 by Reed Richards. After all these years, all of our adventures, we're still together. We're still a team. The greatest team ever. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.